Muddy Knees Media.
For the rest of this month being September 2020, you can take out a subscription to The Athletic for the frankly ridiculous price of just £1 a month. That's unrivaled football writing and analysis from the very best people in the business, a brand spanking new breaking news service, and ad-free versions of each Athletic podcast, all for just £1 a month. Go to theathletic.com/totally to get started.
Totally Football Show, European edition. Today, Ligue 1, hot breast action, and PSG go tits up. Call them PTSG as Neymar and co enter the relegation zone. La Liga, is Bale's weight over? Is Hazard overweight? Plus, previews of who to watch as the Bundesliga and Serie A get back underway this weekend. It's the Totally Football Show, European edition, in association with Paddy Power. Listener, welcome on board. Tuesday, of course, is our day to round up the big continental stories with the big continental experts. I'm talking about Frenchman Julien Laurent.
Hello, James. Hi, everyone.
Hi, Jules.
Oh, that's sweet.
Spain's Alvaro Romeo.
Hello. Ah, guitars, what a surprise.
There we go. Also on the line, Germany's Raphael Honigstein. And I'm afraid we'll have to leave that because it's time for Hull's James Horncastle. Hurrah. Listener, I hope you're enjoying yourself wherever you are. We share so many interests, everybody, but we have one thing in common, and that is we've never looked forward to the French roundup as much as today. Am I right?
You are probably right. Yeah, you're right. You are right, James. I think after the Champions League heroics from PSG and Lyon and the league getting a better profile, I would put it, I think people thought, okay, let's have a look. Maybe, you know, maybe we give them a second chance. French football, we'll have a look at what the biggest game is in the season. You know, we will have great spectacle, great goals, great players, great atmosphere, and none of that.
No, Jules, what I was actually talking about was the breast goal, but we'll touch on that later on. Paris Saint-Germain against Olympique Marseille. Paris Saint-Germain, a whopping story. But just one of the major talking points we'll be touching on today, as I mentioned. Rafa, you're going to be giving us a heads up on what to expect from the brand new Bundesliga season, won't you?
Can I hear the music again? It was so nice.
Yeah, there we go.
I think I should do the whole roundup with the music playing in the background. And Bayern would go on to win a 9th title, and Dortmund are doing quite well.
Okay, and Alvaro, you've got all sorts of things. You're going to be talking bollards later on, aren't you?
Yes, I am, and fortunately, nothing big or no big injuries have happened in Madrid after the decision of the Madrid City Hall of putting big bollards painted like La Liga balls in Madrid's city centre.
Right, these are those bollards that are normally grey and very much stone, and they painted them to look like footballs with predictably disastrous consequences. But anyway, there you go. Alvaro's just holding up a football, which sadly, listener, you can't see, but picture one and you'll have the same effect. James Horncastle, we're looking forward to the new Serie A season and also Shamrock Rovers Milan.
Yeah, on Thursday, these one-off Europa League games, which are a bit of a throwback to what we saw in the 80s pre-Champions League, where there's a real risk of some giant killing. So looking forward to that.
All right. Okay. But first on the agenda, of course, is the big story on Paris, Sunday night, PSG, Olympique Marseille.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Dimitri Payet. C'est bien au second poteau. C'est bien au second poteau pour Florian Thauvin qui avait passé 471 minutes avant ce match.
Sunday night, Paris Saint-Germain losing their second straight game against their hated rivals Olympique Marseille. A match that saw, Jules, was it 18 cards or 19 cards?
So 14 yellows and 5 reds, yeah.
Okay, 19 cards. The setup here, Paris Saint-Germain, who were Champions League finalists a month ago, who've won 7 of the last 8 French titles.
That's right, yeah.
but had been hard hit by coronavirus, had lost their opening game of the season to Lens with half their team out following positive tests. Sunday night then, they took on André Villas-Boas' Marseille in the latest example of the bitterest rivalry in French football. And Jules, it didn't go well for Tuchel's side.
No, I don't think it went well for anyone, really. I mean, Marseille are very happy, of course, because they won for the first time in 10 years in Paris. And I think it was 20 games since they last beat PSG home or away. But it was such a bad atmosphere, really so negative and so toxic. And even before the game, the days previously before the game in the press conferences, both camp were going at each other, either taking the mic or... And you knew already that it would be that kind of atmosphere, that kind of games where there would not be much football played, but there would be a lot of aggression and there would be a lot of contact and there would be a lot of fouls and there would be a lot of all of this. And really, what we feared before the game happened, but probably to an extent that no one would have guessed for, because Marseille played well, they had a game plan, they were very solid defensively, they defended well, they played as a team, that was great. They scored on set pieces, which was, they had a second goal that was disallowed, probably should not have been disallowed, but that's pretty much all they did football-wise. But from PSG's point of view, they were very disappointed. They created chances and Mandanda in goal for Marseille was outstanding. But it just was not much football played at all. And it was a disgraceful game in the sense that both teams, especially Neymar and Alvaro, and we'll come to them a bit later, but both teams were really over the top in the way they played. And it's a real shame because, as I was saying before, I think it was a good time to give good publicity to French football and to Ligue 1. And if people tune in, this game was broadcasted in over 150 countries. You could just imagine people maybe who never watched a Ligue 1 game before tuning in for that. They must have been pretty disappointed.
I'm not so sure, Jules. I've got to say, Paris Saint-Germain losing their first two games of the season and being in the bottom three has sparked a lot of interest, I think, for a lot of neutrals in Le Championnat. This, anyway, was a 1-0 defeat. The goal coming from Florent Thauvin. I don't know if you want to comment at all about Sergio Rico's performance in goal for Paris Saint-Germain. Perhaps we'll hear from you on that in a second. But Rafa?
I just wanted to ask you, Jules, and you sound very negative about the game, which surprises me because the result was very welcome. But why did they put on this?
I wondered which one of you. I really wondered which one of you four. I mean, I knew Alvaro because he's too kind and too nice. So then it was between you three, who I've known the longest. And then I did think, Rafa, you might be the first one, although I thought Horncastle maybe could sneak in something. But yeah, go on, sorry.
I was wondering why they put on a game of this magnitude at the second game of the season. That's usually never happens in any of the big leagues.
Yeah, you're right. I think the new broadcasting deal and the new channel that got created in France, Media Pro, come from Spain, I think wanted to start as early as possible with a big game. So they had the Saint-Étienne-Marseille game, which is also quite a big rivalry, not as big as this one, but on the opening game of the season on a Friday, that was postponed because Marseille was hit at that time by coronavirus. And then they were really keen on having this one very early on. That's why he came so early. Obviously, at the time, no one expected PSG to... Well, no one thought PSG could do that, could go that far in the Champions League. And a few of the PSG players have said it was quite crazy to start the Ligue 1 season on the weekend of the Champions League final, just in case PSG and Lyon could have gone there. It was a bit strange, but there was still a game to be played. PSG still had a decent team on, even if Neymar and Di Maria hardly trained in the last 2 weeks because of coronavirus, even if a lot of other players were missing. They were still a competitive team. And I'm all for rivalry. And obviously, being a PSG fan, you know, we were really good in that one in the last 10 years. But this game, I don't think was played in the right spirit at all. But again, credit for Marseille because they deserve to win. They played really well as a team.
Once the game was drawing to a close, there was this on-field melee which saw various players grappling and battling with each other. The referee showing four red cards, two for each team, but then getting a call from VAR saying that he'd missed one. He checks the sideline monitor. He sees Neymar cuffing Alvaro Gonzalez of Marseille, goes back and shows Neymar the red card. Neymar then says, "I did it because Alvaro has been racially abusing me throughout." Jules, what's the story on this?
Yeah, I mean, already in the first half, you heard him saying to the referee and to the fourth referee, you know, he said some racist stuff to me, and you hear him very clearly saying no racism all the time. And then at the end, like you said, when he leaves the pitch, so Media Pro, the French TV that broadcasted the game, said that they could hear Alvaro racially abusing Neymar during the game. Neymar, as you said, after that, during the night, especially there was another tweet when he said that Alvaro called him a monkey and other racial insults. So the French League and the Discipline Committee will look into this. They will look for audios, of course. They will look for any sort of thing that they could use to see if really that happened or not. I mean, Alvaro put a tweet out on Sunday night, not denying what Neymar was saying, but just saying that there's no room for racism in football. You could have thought that maybe Alvaro would have said, hang on, I never said that. You know, I'm going to defend myself. I'm innocent. Neymar is talking BS or I don't know, whatever. Instead, he posted a photo of him with a lot of his black teammates saying there's no room for racism anywhere in the world. I don't know. We will have to see. Marseille also said that Di Maria spat on Alvaro, which on television, you could certainly see something. And again, the discipline committee will have a look into that, as well as on the 5 red cards. So it'd be a very busy session for the next one for the discipline committee. But obviously the most serious one are the Di Maria spit, but especially I think the racially abused incident between Alvaro and Neymar if it happened again.
I would like to know what will happen with Neymar because he has offended in the past. He's a re-offender. So what's the punishment that is expected for the player? It's not the first time that he's sent off in Ligue 1.
Yeah, I mean, again, the discipline committee will have to look into it. So if in the rule book for a fight, because you could clearly see, especially Kurzawa and Amavi properly exchanging punches and kicks, stuff like that, that could go up to 7 games ban. The racism incident, if it happened again, that's a 10-game ban. The spit is a 6 maximum, I'm talking maximum sentence here, 6-1 for spitting. And Neymar, I guess, would go down to the brutality or slapping someone or punching someone, which then can be up to 7 games. I mean, he was never sent off for punching someone. You know, he'd had red cards before, more by reaction or things like this. So that could play against him for sure. I don't know what's going to happen, but we will know in midweek. We will have to see. It's just not a good look. It's not good for PSG because they're losing 3 more players, already being short because, as we said, many were missing from coronavirus or various injuries and things like that. So we might even have to call back Choupo-Moting and give him a new 1-year deal. But yeah, it's not good for either teams because even Marseille now have that momentum after 2 wins in 2. And they will have to be without Benedetto, without Amavi. So it's not good for anyone, really.
Marseille be playing Lille next week, who are flying high in this start of the season. As for Paris Saint-Germain, it's their worst start to a Ligue 1 campaign since the 80s. They're in the bottom 3. Jules, are they going to be all right? Have they got enough good French lads who know the league well enough to get them out of trouble?
I think what's interesting, and Horny was texting me during the game, and we were sending each other a gif of Max Allegri, of course, because I think the pressure now will intensify quite quickly on Thomas Tuchel. No, of course, there's circumstances on why they lost those 2 games. On Sunday, again, you had some players missing, but it was just not good enough. And I think Tuchel in his coaching in both games was very disappointing. I think there's a bit of patience running out on Leonardo's side. And I think Tuchel should be very, very careful. They play on Wednesday night again against Metz, which there's no way they don't win that game. I mean, I can tell you right now, if they don't win against Metz, then I'm sure he's out of the door. And I think someone like Pochettino or Allegri will obviously be quite keen, I think. But yeah, I think Thomas Tuchel has to put things right pretty quickly.
Okay, Damien would like to know if Marseille can win Ligue 1. Jules, they're 6 points clear of Paris Saint-Germain as it stands. Is that enough?
I don't think 6 is enough. They need a bigger cushion, I think, because eventually PSG will come back and all their players will come back and they will get stronger and they might not lose again this season. But they also could have a very difficult season on the back of the defeat against Bayern Munich in the Champions League, that sort of hangover, plus the bad start, plus if Thomas Tuchel gets out, anything can happen. So I think this is really the year where Marseille, Lyon, Monaco, who've started well, Lille as well, should have a go at it, a proper go at it. Marseille will have to play in the Champions League as well. And when you know the fixture list of the Champions League every week, I think it will be hard because they have a small squad. But they certainly have to believe that, you know, if they are good in the games where they dropped points last season, which was, you know, a few, although they finished second, they can certainly have a pretty good season.
A quick word for Lens, who got that the first win against Paris Saint-Germain of the season. That must have been a night of huge celebration for them.
It was great, and it was obviously their return into the top flight after many years, I think 9 years in the second division. They have such a great support and great fans, and only 5,000 of them were allowed to be at the Stade Bollard, but you could still hear them. It was great. They had a perfect game plan. They went for it. They were really aggressive. That worked well. They deserve to win that game against PSG. And then they won again at the weekend against Lorient. So it's two wins in two. And they're doing a great job there. They've got a great owner who's spending a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of energy in that club. And it's great because they're one of the best clubs in France with, again, the best fans. And they deserve some luck now after some years of not being so good. So good on them. It was a really, really interesting weekend in France, as well as the PSG Marseille game.
Okay, because there was also that extraordinary match between Brest and Dijon, which featured the goal, which I hope, listener, you've had a chance to enjoy by now, from Ivan Cardona, which sounded a little bit like this.
What I said earlier, and it's even the defenseur central écolier
mondial. Oh, là, là, but exceptional!
Well, to quote the great man, you're not going to see a better goal all season. I really wonder if you will, actually, because this was extraordinary. You ever seen anything like that before, Rafa?
I mean, shades of our fascist friend. What's his name? Yeah,
Di Canio. But yeah. This was better, no?
This was height, better. This was better.
The ball is higher.
Yeah, he's up at shoulder level when he does the scissor
remember,
kick.
McManaman is scoring one like this for Real Madrid, but it wasn't nowhere near as good. But the style of the goal was very similar. And another one from Fernando Torres against Betis when he played for Atletico de Madrid. I recommend the listeners to look at it as well because it was there was an athletic display very similar to the goal that we're talking about.
Mm. James Horncastle, you see great goals every week because following Serie A, but this...
For many years.
It was Latin-esque. I think, ultimately. It's the sort of thing that we saw him... I mean, it's a different goal, but in terms of acrobaticism, if that's a word, yeah, it very much felt like a bit of Ibra-Kadabra in terms of height, taekwondo kind of, you know, coming into use. But off the top of my head, can't think of a goal quite like that. It could be,
yeah, there's a strong martial arts feel, the two Cardona's kick.
It's like a Captain Tsubasa for the... For the listeners, and I'm sure many of them, you know about the cartoon on TV, Captain Tsubasa. They score crazy goals like that because it's a cartoon on television, obviously. But it certainly felt very much like Tsubasa scored that goal. James, don't tell me you don't know Captain Tsubasa.
I'm just looking it up now.
Yeah,
Captain
surely.
Captain Tsubasa.
In Spain, we call it differently, I think.
Yeah, in France as well. But Captain Tsubasa.
Oliver
is
and Benji,
name.
We call.
Is yeah, that one same, of those manga ones, yeah?
Yeah, Oliver and Benji, yeah.
It's the same one for us. But the real name is Captain Tsubasa.
Okay.
I'm just watching some Captain Tsubasa on YouTube at the moment.
It's Cardona.
You want to see a goal, you have to wait for 30 minutes. I mean, the show relied on that.
Yeah, the ball spends a lot of time in the air.
Yeah,
the
exactly.
Bit like watching La Liga, no? I have to wait 30 minutes for a goal?
A little bit, yeah. Especially nowadays.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, with the situation in Liga nicely rounded up by Jules then, we'll possibly touch on some of the points later on when we get to your questions, but let's next move down to Spain.
This season, the Premier League's going to be a little bit different. But at Paddy Power, we're trying to embrace the new normal by looking at the upside. Avoid unnecessary journeys, that's Fulham's trip to Anfield off. Fake crowd noise, the Emirates has never sounded so good. Self-isolate. Well, some midfielders do that very effectively. Avoid European travel. Shouldn't be a problem for Everton fans. When you think about it, not that much has changed, really. New normal, same old football. Paddy Power. 18+, begambleaware.org.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is the Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Mira José Luis, otro más de José Luis, y bomba! Golazo, José Luis! Golazo del comandante! El comandante de tu parte de adelante, Levante!
Morales there, with what would have been a Morales-boosting goal for Levante, except that their local rivals Valencia came back and beat them 4-2 in the Derby del Turia and went top of the table as a result. Great stuff there from Valencia under Javi Gracia. However, this is a bit of a shock, Alvaro, because we heard last week how all their players had done one.
Yes, and I still believe that Valencia is under a difficult circumstance. In fact, on Friday before the game. Javi Gracia was very vocal about the ownership of the club, and he said that all the promises that the ownership did to him hadn't been met, that he needed more players, and those players are not arriving at Valencia. One of the players he wants to sign is Etienne Capoue. He knows that the player can come on the cheap to Valencia for 3-4 million, but he's not getting the players he's asking for. So yeah, the game arrived in a little bit of a turbulent situation for Valencia after Javi Gracia, who is a man of harmony, but he had to speak out for himself and his players. After Javi Gracia said that basically the ownership wasn't helping him to make a better team. But Valencia won it, as you said, and he's not only the leader, but also Vallejo, one of their strikers, is the top scorer of the competition. So it wasn't such a bad week after all, but if you see Valencia's squad, you will see that there has been a clear drop of quality in there. Garay has been replaced by Mangala or Diakabi. Coquelin or Parejo for a player called Esquerdo. Rodrigo, the Leeds striker, for Canning Lee, and Ferran Torres for Musa, former Arsenal Academy player. So, yes, obviously there is a drop of quality, but at the same time, it was very nice to see how Canning Lee, and especially Musa, a player who is still 17 years old, were capable of competing in the Spanish top flight. And yeah, Valencia got a victory that is quite important for them in a night that was supposed to be Morales' night, because he scored the brace and he played beautifully.
You talked about turbulent situation. Valencia aren't the only ones. La Liga in general with one or two issues. For a start, there's the ongoing conflict between the Federation and the league and whether they can play matches on Friday and Saturday night. The opening game of the season had to be postponed over that. Secondly, you have the fact that, as you mentioned, Alvaro, there's been almost no transfer activity. 16 of the Liga's clubs have spent less than 10 million over the summer. 10 clubs have spent nothing in transfer fees. The likes of Real Madrid have so far, at least, only called in Martin Odegaard back from loan from Real Sociedad. What's the mood as this season gets underway then in Spain?
Well, I think the mood is not as optimistic as some other years. I remember back in the late 90s, La Liga called itself La Liga de las Estrellas, the League of Stars, because all together with Italy, all the talent was coming to Spain, and was coming to teams that were able to allocate it. I remember that Betis at some point signing the Nilsson back in 1997. They got one of the most expensive transfers at the time. So, but it has changed a lot. At the minute, there are only three clubs who can actually allocate expensive talent, Atlético de Madrid, Barcelona and Real Madrid. That's the situation. And many clubs in La Liga rely on either young players or old players that return to La Liga. And one of the perfect examples of that is David Silva returning to Real Sociedad. So, yes, this is a new shape of La Liga. I think that is down to the financial crisis, especially after the COVID-19. Every team is quite cautious when it comes to spending, because they know that this season is going to be difficult with no fans. The morphology of the league is a little bit like that. There are many, many youngsters playing and getting a lot of quality time. Then some very good youngsters, they leave too early, far too early, like Ferran Torres, because Valencia can simply not match the salaries that some other clubs can pay. And then there are some old players that are returning to La Liga just to play their last couple of years. So Santi Cazorla was another one like that. So yeah, this is what La Liga is about now. And I think that the best thing that La Liga can do at the minute, or the clubs can do, is invest in their academies and in the best coaches they can, which is, for example, something that Valencia or Villarreal are trying to do.
Sam asking why Real Madrid have been so quiet, not complaining or anything, says Sam, it's just a bit weird. Is it the same rationale for them? Uncertainty over the future?
Yeah, a little bit, yes. Even though we have to say that their finances are still fine. I was reading yesterday that Real Madrid returned 25% of the season fee tickets to the season ticket holders. Real Madrid has lost some money because the VIP area is closed, the museum is closed. And all that said, Real Madrid still made some revenue for last season. So I think that from all the clubs in La Liga, Real Madrid is one of those that is doing pretty well, and especially navigating very well the crisis. On top of that, they have sold already James Rodríguez, Oscar Rodríguez to Sevilla, Achraf Hakimi to Inter Milan. And I think, of course, to sell Reguilón to an English club, probably, especially after Sevilla has signed already Acuña, a player who will play in the left back, because Sevilla knows that they cannot afford Reguilón if Manchester United gets involved in the negotiations as well. So, yeah, I think Real Madrid are making a lot of money with sales. They are loaning young players. And if they want to make expensive signing, I think that they could still do it.
You haven't mentioned Gareth Bale in there, in the potential outgoings.
Well, James, just to complete this, Gareth Bale is one of those players that Real Madrid could offload. But I think that the problem is that no club has made a genuine offer for him. And there are a couple of more that could leave as well and could leave some money to Real Madrid. One of them will be Lucas Vázquez and the other one will be Mariano. So, yeah, I think that Real Madrid has still attractive prospects that they can put in the market.
Okay. Real Madrid weren't in action this week, of course, because they came back late from the Champions League action. The same goes for Barcelona and Atletico Madrid. What is the background, by the way? What is the battle going on between the Liga and the FA, which meant that all the Friday Monday games have been cancelled?
Well, it's quite... I'll put it very simply. I mean, the Spanish FA stopped La Liga from starting on Friday, as it was supposed to happen, with a game between Granada and Athletic de Bilbao. There is a court sentence from last September saying that for games to be played on Fridays and Monday, La Liga has to agree on that with the Spanish FA. So it has to be an agreement before games are scheduled on Friday and Mondays. So La Liga disagrees with that, says that during the current pandemic and as fans cannot make it to the grounds, which was the main point that the Spanish FA was making. Fans don't want to go to the ground on Fridays and Mondays. Well, since La Liga disagrees with all this and thinks that they could put the schedule or make the schedule on their own without asking the Spanish FA, there will be a trial on the 6th of October to see who's right.
Okay, wow. Now, in action that did take place, Athletic Bilbao got off to a bad start, losing 2-0 away at Granada. Villarreal, Unai Emery's Villarreal, had a 1-1 draw with Huesca. The Huesca was a wonderful team move.
I think so, yeah. I mean, I have to say that I like the goal about Huesca a lot, but I also think that some of the ball controls of Huesca's midfielders were a little bit lucky. I don't want to be a downer with this, because I think that the finish of Maffeo, the player who played for Manchester City in the past, was fantastic. And then, as you said before, I mean, Huesca scored a beautiful goal. They are newly promoted. And Villarreal got a disappointing result because under Unai Emery and after all the investment they have done, they probably thought that they could get the 3 points and a great start from this game. But after all and all the things considered, I think that it's been a kind of a positive weekend for Villarreal because Coquelin picked an injury. It looked like it was going to be a very bad one. And fortunately, Villarreal sent a statement on Sunday saying that his injury wasn't that bad and that, there is nothing serious in his knee.
All right. Also positive, meanwhile, lots of players and managers for COVID, including David Silva, who's only just, of course, returned to La Liga. Diego Simeone also. All these positive tests, just generally, guys. A lot of the evidence is that if you do get the coronavirus, it can have potentially very, very long-term impact on your health, on your kind of physical abilities and that. So far, has there been any suggestions of players' careers being impaired or potentially damaged or curtailed by this? Or are all these players who are testing positive asymptomatic so far?
In France, we had, back when the pandemic was really at its highest, we had Junior Sambia, the Montpellier midfielder, who got taken to A&E because he was really bad. And there was a point where I think him and his family and the club as well thought that he might not make it. That's the most serious case we had, and we had plenty, especially since this season has started in France. And most of the players, as you said, have been asymptomatic, but Junior was one of the ones that really, really could have gone really bad.
Mm. But has that been the case in, say, the Bundesliga, Serie A as well, that these positive tests are actually for people who are not displaying the symptoms and therefore, you know, not necessarily going to pick up lung damage or anything?
I mean, in Germany, they've been very careful not to reveal their identity, even though some of the players tested positively. But to my knowledge, none of those who have actually developed any serious complications. It could be, and we just don't know.
Right. Aurelio De Laurentiis, the Napoli owner, also resulting positive last week. And this was after he'd travelled to Milan for Liga meetings and stuff. And am I right in thinking that there's been the threat of legal action against him, James, as a result?
Yeah, because I believe he had a test before he went to Milan for this meeting, in which every club in the league had a representative attending. It was a very important meeting because it was about deciding whether or not to go the way of accepting a bid from one of these various different private equity groups that are looking to buy a 10% stake in a media company that will be selling Serie A's TV rights around the world. But with De Laurentiis, yes, he underwent before the meeting, and then he didn't get the result of the test until afterwards. So, you know, obviously he is endangering the other people at that meeting of infection. But I mean, more generally in Italy, you know, we've had lots of players, coaches coming back from Sardinia, for example, and testing positive, having been asymptomatic. I remember seeing some of the documentation around the protocol that they were putting together to get the league restarted, which had a lot of detail on the debilitating impact the virus can have on respiratory and particularly on anyone's lungs or anyone's heart as well, if they get it particularly bad. But yeah, at the moment, yeah, I think it's going to be very curious. I mean, we've seen obviously the impact in Liga, where what was it, Jules, with, as you were saying earlier, with that Marseille Saint-Etienne game that got postponed. I think ended up playing this week. I'm not sure that will be the last case of that. I think Italy's women's team was supposed to be playing in Israel this week, and for different reasons, Israel has gone under, I think it's a quarantine, and so that game's been cancelled. So, you know, I think as the situation continues to kind of fluctuate around the world, it's I think we'll be seeing more disruption.
I touch wood before saying this, but probably for young players, the lethality of the virus is not that bad, but the contagion rate can affect the competition a lot. I remember that the Spanish second division playoff was tremendously affected by the fact that some Fuenlabrada players tested positive. And yet, to the point that the whole playoff system had to be rescheduled like 10 days after the games they should have been played. So I think that is a minor danger in comparison to losing a life, obviously, but we will still see a lot of coronavirus-related inconveniences in La Liga and in every European competition.
Right. Well, indeed. Next up, let's cheer ourselves up with a bit of transfer talk.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power.
Hurrah, transfers. Jules, market's open for ages yet. You're talking about Wesley Fofana wanting to join Leicester. What's the latest on that?
Well, the latest is Saint-Etienne rejected the first bid of 30 million euros for Fofana. They don't want to sell him. He really, really, really wants to leave to join Leicester. He believes this is a great chance for him, a great opportunity. He renewed his contract not long ago to stay at Saint-Etienne. So Saint-Etienne would get some money if he was going to leave, a bit like Saliba did before signing to Arsenal. So he doesn't really understand why they don't want to let him go. I think that Claude Puel would be quite stubborn, and that's the best word to sum up Claude Puel anyway, and would want to keep him even against his will and against his desire. But it's one that we have to close. It's still a long time before now and the end of the transfer window, so I guess that can happen. And you saw that Leicester had to play Wilfred Ndidi as centre-back on Sunday against West Brom, so they really, really need someone. And I believe that if they would not spend too much time chasing Fofana, unfortunately for him. I mean, if they can see it's a no, then they would move on to another of their targets. So it would be a shame. He's a wonderful player, really, really talented. But Leicester cannot wait for him for too long either.
Meantime, Rennes top of Ligue 1, but Camavinga is top of Real Madrid's shopping list. Is that right, Alvaro? And is he really going to go?
It's been reported in Spain, and there is a genuine interest of Real Madrid on this player. All that said, I mean, I refer myself to what I said about Real Madrid finances. They are good. They haven't had any losses from last season. They are not in the position yet to make like a very, very, very big signing. But at the same time, they just have to offload a couple of players that they still have a good name in the market. And I believe that then Real Madrid could do it. Yeah, of course. But I don't know if this is the player Real Madrid needs, really. Considering that last season, Karim Benzema was the only competent striker, and he's already 32, 33 years old. And yeah, I mean, if you want to compete for La Liga, to retain the title and to win Champions League, you'd better have a backup striker to Karim Benzema. And Luka Jovic, so far, is not that player.
Alvaro, are Barcelona buying Hector Bellerin?
That's unlikely, because Barcelona doesn't have money now, and for all the sales that they are doing, they are not getting a lot of money. In fact, Arturo Vidal is meeting Barcelona representatives, and Barcelona's board basically to leave, and he will probably leave for a symbolic fee if he does. So Barcelona doesn't have a lot of money, and the last report is that if they want to get Hector Bellerin, they will try to get him on loan, which I don't see how that will play out for Arsenal. I don't see them accepting that. So that's unlikely to happen, really, because if Barcelona wants to sign a player of that quality, they will have to sign him for 35 plus millions. And at the minute, they just can't use their money for that because there are some other areas of the pitch that they have to populate first.
And Rafa, just while we're on the subject of transfers, no news from your various ongoing stories?
No, there are some news, actually, about David Alaba and his latest negotiations with Bayern, because Uli Hoeneß, the Bayern honorary president, came on television on Sunday and spoke about Alaba's agent, Pini Zahavi, being a money-greedy piranha over his demands, saying that Zahavi's asking for a double-figure sum in the millions just for the signature, and alleging that David Alaba wants to be in line with the best paid players at Bayern, Lewandowski and Neuer, and that Bayern couldn't accept these demands. Zahavi's camp and the father of David Alaba, who's also acting as his agent, have said that these allegations are nonsense, that numbers hadn't been discussed with Zahavi, and that the idea that it's all about money is a dirty lie.
Right.
So really hotting up nicely, that story.
Is there any chance that Uli Hoeneß, given his background in finances, meant it as a compliment?
I don't think he meant it as a compliment. I don't think he was necessarily aware that the idea of running down a contract, which he alleged might be happening with Thiago's suitors, he mentioned Man United and Liverpool, he called it lacking style. But of course, again, that's not a strategy that Bayern themselves have been averse to in recent years. Most famously running down Robert Lewandowski's contract without making a serious offer. He was saying that in his view, Thiago had a deal agreed with either Liverpool or Man United or both. That's quoting him. But they had not made any attempt to actually sign him, and he expected them to make a lowball offer right at the end of the transfer window to, in his quotes, blackmail us. So these are the news from Bayern.
What's your impression of Thiago? Has he made an agreement with both Liverpool and Man United?
I don't know about Man United. I think the Liverpool rumours are very strong for obvious reasons. I think emanating from the dressing room, backed up by some of the reports that there has been contact. It doesn't really matter unless Bayern and Liverpool agree a deal. And Bayern, I think, being frustrated and being a little bit unnerved by the fact that those offers, those bids have not been forthcoming. Whether that's really a strategy on Liverpool's behalf, or maybe just a case of them having to sell one or two players before they're in a position to do that, I'm not sure. But certainly, the idea that Thiago has some kind of agreement with Liverpool is something that Bayern themselves believe. So that's where you get Uli Hoeneß's view from. I think the United thing is probably less acute. I think it's still more about Liverpool and when will they show their hand, if at all. Just one more on Alaba, just quickly. Of course, the fear from Bayern is that these demands, which Kicker reported as high as 25 million euros a year for 5 years, which is something that Bayern find very, very hard to agree with. There is a chance that the demand is only so high because actually they don't want a new agreement, and that the end game is actually running down the contract. Alaba, like Thiago, has one more year left. So if he were to run that down, then next season he could go to Spain, where he wants to go. This year there's just not enough money at Barcelona or Real Madrid to make that kind of deal happen. There'll be more money available for his agents, because for a free player, you save the transfer fee, but the money usually goes to the agents in one way or the other, that the clubs would be saving on the transfer fee. So that could be the end game here. And that's, again, Bayern find it hard to deal with when someone does to them the way that they tend to do to others.
Mm, we all do, Rafa. We all do. Richard Sox wants to know how close we think City are to signing Koulibaly. James.
This is quite the saga, because City and Napoli are not talking directly to each other after a fallout a couple of years ago about the Jorginho transfer, which never happened, at least from Napoli to City. He ended up going to Maurizio Sarri's Chelsea instead. Napoli still want a lot of money for Koulibaly. They're not backing down from, I think their current post-COVID asking price is around €75 million. And yeah, that's not something at the moment that City have been particularly inclined to move their offer up to. So, I think as the season gets closer and closer, there's going to be even more brinkmanship, because I think Gattuso wants to know who's in his team next year. And likewise, the Premier League season's already started. City would like to know who is going to be at the back for them. So at the moment, there's still a bit of an impasse, despite Fally Ramadani, the often in the newspapers agent who also did the Leroy Sané deal from City to Bayern, trying to get this deal over the line, but facilitated by this kind of cold relationship, I suppose, between Napoli and City.
Right, excellent. Well, we'll be hearing about the Serie A season very, very shortly. And next up, though, let's touch on the return of the Bundesliga. We'll be asking the big questions like, who'll be second this time around?
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Raphael Honigstein, Bayern Munich are the European champions and they kick off the Bundesliga season. They're at home to Schalke on Friday night. Also coming up on the opening weekend, which is now days away, it's the Borussia Derby, Dortmund against Mönchengladbach. That's Saturday at 5:30. Rafa, can anyone stop Bayern? Who looks best placed? And what teams, what surprises can you promise us?
Well, it's the usual story, really. I mean, Bayern are huge favourites, especially after adding Leroy Sané, but Dortmund have a great squad and Dortmund haven't lost anyone at the time of recording. They kept all their big players for another season, with the possible exception of Hakimi. But they've managed to add Thomas Meunier for that fullback position. They've been able to get Jude Bellingham in. They've also have Renier, who's a young Brazilian from Real Madrid on loan. So this is a strong squad. The question is, can they have the kind of consistency that you need to live with what is now the best team in Europe? It's going to be tough. It's going to be tough for anyone in this league to compete with Bayern. The one thing that I think might work in everybody's favour is that Bayern are, at the moment, a pretty thin squad, and they could still lose a couple of players that we just talked about. And they find it very difficult to spend money on the replacements that they would need. Having let Perisic go, they're now down two wide attacking midfielders, not just one. They are still in the market for a right back. So there is a bit of weakness, which Hansi Flick himself has acknowledged or has warned of. And, you know, once you factor in all the amount of games that they'll be playing, plus the international games from some of their players, maybe it can turn into one of those crazy seasons that we used to see in the noughties, when Bayern would still be able to have an off year here and there. And you saw champions like Stuttgart, Wolfsburg and Bremen, and later, of course, Jürgen Klopp's Dortmund take advantage. So it's not impossible, but it's going to be very difficult.
And were that to happen, you see Dortmund as being well placed. And who else? Mönchengladbach by Leverkusen?
I mean, I really like Borussia Mönchengladbach. They have a strong side, and they also have been able to keep all their big players together. The question is, with the Champions League for them, will that just prove a little bit too much? I think it's difficult to see how that team can deal with that without losing a bit of sharpness, because they work very hard to win their games. They don't have quite the same level of individual quality, and as a result, they have to work collectively very hard to win games. And I think the mental drain of having, you know, Real Madrid on a Tuesday and then you're away to Freiburg on a Saturday or Sunday, I think that might be a little bit too difficult for them to deal with when it comes to challenging for the title. Leverkusen, without Havertz, without Folland, they're rebuilding a team. Patrick Schick has moved there, which has been a great buy for them. But I think it's difficult to see them being involved in the title race. The big question mark is Leipzig, because Leipzig have lost Timo Werner, their most important player. They're still trying to sign an adequate replacement. It's proving very difficult for them in the current climate. And you wonder, will they keep improving as they have last year under Nagelsmann, or will they kind of regressing or stalling? But in theory, they should be in a position to push Bayern just a little bit, as they did last year, to be fair. We had a title race. It was just towards the final quarter of the season that Bayern pulled away. And I think it could well be a similar story this year.
Okay. High hopes for Dortmund Mönchengladbach on this Saturday?
Yeah, should be a really good game. I mean, both are great sides on the ball, especially Dortmund, with all their weaknesses, very rarely play any dull games. They score a lot, they concede a lot of chances. So yeah, should be a really good game.
Okay. And Hertha Berlin, have they been spending crazy money again this summer?
Not so much. They spent a little bit, but a lot of the investment has already been going into the team. You know, they made these huge signings in the January market with the likes of Piontek coming in. So I think there's still a plan to spend a bit more, but they also find it a little bit difficult right now to get the kind of players in that they want. They have Lucas Toussaint, of course, joining them from Lyon. That was a player that they'd already signed, but then delayed the move, and I have high hopes for him.
Rafael, I just wonder about Werder Bremen, because they've been needing relegation for a number of seasons, and they managed to survive. So I wonder if this can be that season when they definitely go down to the second division.
Yeah, and that worry is one that's being shared by a lot of people, of course, in Bremen as well. There's still a lot of talk that Milo Rashica, who's been their best player, might go. Clubs in the Premier League interested in him, other clubs in the Bundesliga, but perhaps being priced out. There's not a lot of money around. The last time the league spent as little collectively was 2012, so basically almost a decade ago. That just shows you just how tight the money is, and it's difficult for Werder, who really should have strengthened but simply aren't in a position to do so.
Well, looking forward to seeing all of that getting back underway this weekend, and equally to Serie A resuming activities. And we'll finish off today's Totally Football Show European edition with a big look at what awaits in Italy next.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is the Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
For nine straight seasons, teams have begun the Serie A season, hopeful that maybe this would be the year that they'd end Juve's dominance. But for nine straight years, La Signora has finished on top. James, is it going to be different this time around?
Well, I mean, they only won the league by a point last year. And I suppose part of that was because after they won the league title, they relaxed a little in view of the final eight of the Champions League, but they'd also been pretty shaky. Let's not get away from that. Juventus had the third best defence last year, the fifth best attack. They've regressed, I would say, over the last couple of years. They've appointed a rookie coach. We know a lot about Pirlo, the player. We don't know a lot about Pirlo, the manager, and we're going to find out what he's like starting Sunday against Claudio Ranieri's Sampdoria. So in some respects, I do think this feels open compared with not other years, because, I mean, there have been title races in recent times. You think of Maurizio Sarri's last year at Napoli, for example. But there are certainly going to be teams that have more continuity than Juventus. You know, Conte is coming back for a second year after having that summit with the club after the Europa League final, which they lost to Sevilla. I think Milan, as I said last week, have done some really good business in the transfer window and don't seem like they're done yet. And Atalanta, we've seen Papu Gomez turn down a big move to the Gulf, I think. I can't remember whether it was in Saudi Arabia or Qatar, but certainly more life-changing money for Papu. He's decided to stay. And Josip Iličić has come back. Remains to be seen whether he's ready to begin training again with the first team. They're not rushing him back at this moment in time, but that's certainly a positive thing for them. More generally, I think Napoli were one of the big disappointments last year, James, but they sort of improved a lot under Rino Gattuso. They won the cup. They've made the biggest signing of the transfer window so far in Victor Osimhen from Lille. I expect them to do better than they did last year. So in some respects, you've got seven teams, I would say, at the top, not at the standards of the Seven Sisters at the 90s, but seven teams who I would say were definitely better than the rest in Serie A. I think it's going to be very difficult for the likes of Bologna, Sassuolo, Verona, Fiorentina, even to break into that group, if you like, at the top of the table. I'm very curious to see how Juventus play under Andrea Pirlo. We got a flavour on Sunday when they played a friendly against Novara, but that's third division Novara. I don't think we can really take too many indications from that, other than little bits about how they're looking to defend, how they're looking to build up. I think it's going to be a very good season.
Juve Sampdoria is on Sunday night. Gonzalo Higuain, who's in the meantime moved off to Inter Miami with Luis Suarez, on the verge of signing up for La Signora. Parma-Napoli is earlier on Sunday. That's one to look out for. Roma, we're getting their campaign underway against Verona. But fresh bad news for poor Nicolò Zaniolo, who did his ACL, or at least did his other ACL, in Italy's 1-0 victory away in Amsterdam over the Netherlands.
Yeah, and so much about Zaniolo's game is his explosiveness, his ability to pick up the ball, turn and drive at opposition defences. And I think that was one of the things that was so encouraging when he initially did come back from his first knee blowout, because he didn't look any different than the player that we'd seen, up until last January. So, the hope, I suppose, is that with a cautious approach, that he will get back to his best. I think, he wanted to take some time after the injury on last Monday to assess his options. I think they looked at maybe going to the same specialist that Ibrahimovic had seen in the States, but obviously traveling to the States at this moment in time is difficult with their restrictions and limitations around the pandemic. So they chose to go to Innsbruck instead. So a big blow for him, a big blow for Roma, because Roma have undergone a takeover in the meantime, and they've only signed one player so far, and that's Pedro on a free transfer from Chelsea. They're still trying to do the Chris Smalling deal, but their focus at the moment has really been on bringing money in from sales. Schick will help a little bit in that, although a lot of that money that Leverkusen are paying them is going to go to Sampdoria. They've got a lot of work to do. And of course, there's some speculation around the future of Edin Dzeko, as Juventus are still looking to sign a centre-forward to replace Gonzalo Higuain. They're in talks with Luis Suarez, but Suarez has got to sit this Italian exam at the University of Perugia before he can even get to a stage where they might give him a passport, and that's still not a given. And obviously, yes, there is some time between now and the end of the transfer window on October 5th, but we all know how Italian bureaucracy works. It does take some time. It's not like something can happen overnight. So there's a lot of plates spinning in the air at the moment among a number of clubs. And I think that's one of the reasons why the business that Milan have done so far is so impressive, because they've been able to get players in early, which they need to with these Europa League games coming thick and fast.
and they may not be done yet with the transfers. Some word that they might be looking to acquire Federico Chiesa to furnish Ibra with crosses and that. Speaking of the Europa League, meantime, second qualifying round of that competition will see Milan visiting Shamrock Rovers on Thursday. Lewis Cassidy asked, what kind of team are Milan likely to put out against Shamrock Rovers? How seriously will they take the competition as a whole?
Very seriously. They are worried about this game. I was lucky enough to spend a lot of time with various people at Milan last week, and there was concern because it's a one-off game, and anything can happen in that situation. You have an off day, then it doesn't really matter who you play against. You know, Shamrock Rovers, I think, have played already 11 games in the League of Ireland. They're unbeaten. They've got the best defence as well. So, you know, obviously there is a massive talent disparity there, but this is a team that has minutes in its legs, has that winning feeling, and you know, sometimes that can make all the difference, even if you are playing against a very good side like Milan, who ended last season on a high, have kind of added to that momentum, signing the likes of Sandro Tonali and Brahim Diaz. We need to see who exactly is available for the game. There's some doubts, I think, around Zlatan and the registration of some of their new players. But, you know, still on paper, there should be enough there, more than enough to beat Shamrock Rovers. But, you know, as we say, in these one-off games against a side that has played a lot more football than Milan in this period, you know, it's not something that they can take for granted and turn up thinking casually that they'll just wipe the floor with them. So it's going to be very interesting to see.
Mm. All right, welcome to Shamrock, as Damian Marley
okay.
So nearly observed. Just a final word then on the sides coming up from Serie B, La Spezia, Crotone and Benevento, because of course it's Pippo Inzaghi back in the big time.
Yeah, Super Pippo, one of this group of former Milan players who are now coaching, along with Pirlo and Gattuso, for example, who will be coming up against. He'll also be playing against his brother, Simone, who's coach of Lazio, and they'll be hoping to do a lot better than Benevento did last time round when they were in Serie A, a couple of years ago, and they didn't get a single point until December.
When they played Milan, wasn't it?
When they played Gattuso's Milan, and their goalkeeper scored in the final minutes I think it was in stoppage time to get them a point. So, you know, they're doing a kind of crazy, eclectic summer kind of transfer window at the moment. They tried to get Loic Remy, and then I think there were some problems with his medical, and they ended up pulling out of that. But yeah, as for the other ones, I mean, Spezia, I think they came up through the playoffs. It's their first time in Serie A, even though they have got a Scudetto to their name back in the war years when the firemen of Spezia won the national title. They've got a really interesting coach, Vincenzo Italiano, who has won promotion in three consecutive years with three different teams at various different levels of Italian football. And then there's Crotone, who are back as well, the Pythagoreans. So I'm curious to see which one of those will, if any of them, can do what Verona did last year, what Parma did the year before, and really establish themselves back in the top flight. Because, to be honest, usually two of the three promoted clubs struggles to get past 30 points. So it's been you know, one of the arguments for Serie A going back to being an 18-team league rather than a 20-team league.
Absolutely. Crotone, you'd like to think they'd be good on corners. But, you know, we'll see.
Can they square it? Yeah.
Can they square it? Indeed. Very nice. All right, then. Well, that will all be getting underway this weekend. We'll be addressing one or two of your Twitter questions, listener, in a second or two. But first of all, let's get some odds from Lee Price.
Okay, just a second. Has everyone skipped? Great. Then I'll begin. I'm still refreshing on English football, let alone European, but Germany are immediately serving us up some fire with Dortmund-Gladbach on Saturday evening. Dortmund are odds on to win this at 8-15, with Gladbach surely intriguing value at 7-2. I don't know if anyone listens to this, let alone regularly, but I often talk up the draw when it's tight, and here That's priced at 16-5. Bayern Munich, by the way, are 1-10 to start of a win against Schalke and 1-7 to win the league. Speaking of being seriously fancied, Andrea Pirlo begins his reign at Juventus, with our odds suggesting we could be in for the closest Serie A title race for some time. Juve remain the favourites, obvs, but they're not odds on. This is not a drill. It's actually the well-drilled Inter that the cause of this. Conte's men 15-8 to win the league. Juve evens. The old lady are odds on, though, to start the season with a win. They're 2-9 to beat Sampdoria, who are 9-1 to spring a major shock. Pirlo versus Ranieri, lovely versus lovely, like seeing your crush fight your nan. Hey, whatever you're into.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. Alvaro, Joe Michel Mella asks, any news on the Spanish Cup final?
It's very simple. Real Sociedad and Athletic de Bilbao said that they wanted to play it with supporters in the ground. And that meant that the cup was effectively forwarded to 2021. The idea of the Spanish FA is to play the 1920 cup final at least a week before the 2021 cup final. That will happen potentially in April. And whether that will happen with supporters or not is still to be seen, because the pandemic in Spain at the minute is hitting the hospitals and the population quite badly.
But the idea is to have back-to-back cup finals.
Yeah, 1 week after another. Yeah, definitely in spring 2021 should be the moment when the Spanish cup final takes place. But of course, I think that Athletic de Bilbao and Real Sociedad will try to delay it as much as possible so some supporters can go to the ground and watch it there, because that was the reason why it was postponed in first place.
Okay. Here's a question from Jake Callahan, who says, can the panel think of another example of a manager being younger than one of their own players? Mine, says Jake, is Pirlo and Buffon. I imagine, Rafa, that there must be some of this.
Julian Nagelsmann.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Okay, well, there's one.
Stramaccioni with Zanetti back in the day.
Did he not? Was he not in charge briefly of Roma and Totti as well?
No. He was famously, well, he wasn't part of a trade. There was once the story that he was going to become the first coach to be exchanged for a player, I think, when I think Inter wanted to swap him for Nicolas Burdisso or something, and that never ended up happening. So, no, he didn't get the opportunity to coach. I imagine maybe one of his Udinese players when he was the first team coach there might have been
Strama.
Strama.
Okay, Alvaro.
When Javier Clemente, the former Spanish national team coach, when he won two titles with Athletic de Bilbao, two league titles, he was still in his late 20s, early 30s, so he was definitely younger than some players.
Okay, very good. Alvaro, how overweight is Eden Hazard? Does he have an Eden Hazard, if you know what I mean?
A little bit, yeah. I think that he should be concerned about that, but especially he should be concerned, James, about what Roberto Martinez said, the Belgian manager, that he has to look after that ankle from now on for his entire career with treatments both before and after the games, because, yeah, he hasn't had any good fitness lately, and he had an ankle surgery as well in February, and he hasn't been fully recovered ever since. So, yeah, I think that you can associate the overweight to his lack of training, unfortunately for him.
Okay. And one final one for now from Mike Buchanan, who says, is it true that HH Helenio Herrera used to instruct his Inter team not to wash and brush their teeth for 3 days before games? If so, says Mike, it's an ingenious tactic. Who would want to man-mark a player with bad body odour and garlic breath?
Well, I think we discussed a couple of weeks ago that Bonucci's mental coach used to recommend that he have these kind of garlic sweets, so he would then kind of breathe in opponents' faces. No, I mean, there were all sorts of things that Herrera did. Didn't he? He had those motivational slogans above the kind of dressing room door, which I can't remember. It said something plus something equals something. I imagine it was victory.
You don't have to be mad to work here, but it helps. That was another one.
Taca la pala, which is, yeah, just, yeah, pass the
ball.
At least
Italian food smells pretty good anyway, so I don't think that that strategy in Italy would be so bad for the opponent.
He used to make a great coffee, apparently, Herrera. Great coffee as well.
Is that right?
Yeah. Really okay. Used to wake you up, get you going.
El Mago. Very good. Well, on that earth-shattering note, that's where we come to the end of today's Totally Football Show European edition. Come next Tuesday, we'll have two more leagues to tell you all about, plus the big guns back in action in La Liga as well. So make sure you join us for that to get all the latest from the continent. For now, it's many, many thanks to Jules, Alvaro, Raphael and James, and you, listener. Do hope you have a wonderful week, and we'll catch you in 7 days' time.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and follow us at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all of The Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on the Athletic app. The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
Muddy Knees Media.